Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
The NFL season may be over, but the action in the NBA, college basketball, and the NHL is heating up. There's only one place to get in on the action, betonline.ag. Create a free account on betonline.ag and receive a 50% sign-up bonus just by using the promo code PODCAST1. Betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PODCAST1.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio. And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am currently out on vacation, recharging batteries, but just because I'm recharging the batteries, we still got business to take care of. In the meantime, we'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
All right, welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. It's producer Sean bringing you episode number 39 with one of my favorite wrestlers, Samoa Joe. Original air date, August 20th, 2013. This is around the time where Joe is still in TNA. It's just under 2 years from him joining NXT and eventually the WWE main roster, but he's still in TNA at the time, and he's in the middle of the Aces and Eights saga that TNA had going on. Steve and Joe talk about Joe breaking into pro wrestling through judo, also Joe's Japanese and lucha influence, working with Kenta Kobashi, the great Japanese wrestler, Joe's endurance in the ring, and even some video games. Quite a packed episode with Samoa Joe coming up here. This day in Steve Austin history, this day being February 7th, in 1993 at the Omni in Atlanta, Dustin Rhodes, Ricky Steamboat, and Shane Douglas defeated Barry Windham, Steve Austin, and Brian Pillman in an elimination match, which ended with Ricky Steamboat pinning Steve Austin after rolling through a Steve Austin crossbody. Then we jump over to 1997 in Pittsburgh. On this day, Bret Hart and Sid defeated Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin in a tag match. Finally, now you have to apologize because I messed up the other day, but in 1999 at Madison Square Garden in New York City, I said this happened on Tuesday, but it happened on February 7th, Steve Austin and Mankind defeated The Rock and Big Boss Man in a Rattlesnake Rules match. I've never heard of a Rattlesnake Rules match, but I would imagine it falls in line with a tornado tag type of match. So that's what happened on February 7th, this day in Steve Austin history. I got my information from ProFightDB.com and TheHistoryOfWWE.com, two fine sites that were able to provide this information. Coming up after the break, we're going to be joined by Steve and Samoa Joe on a classic episode of The Steve Austin Show.
NFL season is officially over, but that doesn't mean that the sports action in the NBA, college basketball, and NHL is taking a break. It's hotter than ever, and each game becomes that much more important. For instance, in the NHL, Tampa, New York, Winnipeg, and Calgary currently all sit on top of their divisions. Will Washington get a chance to repeat the Stanley Cup? Can Vegas repeat its magic from last year to get back on top? Plus, Toronto and Nashville are teams to watch. As I've been saying for months, there's only one place here at Podcast One that has all the action you're looking for. BetOnline.ag. Sign up today for a free account on BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 to receive a 50% sign-up bonus. Again, that's betonline.ag for all the details. And while you're there, use promo code PODCAST1. That's PODCAST O-N-E to get a 50% sign-up bonus. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action with betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Today, my guest here on the Steve Austin Show is none other than Samoa Joe. Samoa, how are you?
I'm fantastic, man. That's quite an intro, man. I feel very honored right now.
Dude, where are you calling from today? We're sitting in Los Angeles. I know you come from Huntington Beach out here, but where are you at right now?
Yeah, well, actually, we just shipped it over. It's school time, so we're back out here in our East Coast base in Tampa. And, we try to stay in Cali half the year and out here in Florida half the year, but, we're back out here in Florida.
Dude, I've been watching a ton of your matches starting last night, and, of course, you know, I follow you on Twitter and vice versa. And you can follow Joe at Twitter, too, on at Samoa Joe, and put over your work several times. Dude, when I was talking to you a couple of times before we started talking about doing this show, I said, man, who trained you? And you mentioned the cat named Cincinnati Red. I had not heard of Cincinnati Red. Now, is he from Cincinnati or is he from Cleveland? Tell me about this cat.
No, he's from the San Fernando Valley out in California.
Of course, parts unknown.
No, he's one of those journeyman pro wrestlers that, you know, made his bones out there on the scene, did a lot of work down in Mexico and back and forth. And because of that, you know, he had a lot of lucha training, he had a lot of different training. So, I mean, you know, he was largely responsible for, like, a lot of the agility and a lot of the drills and, you know, a lot of the technique that I use now. Just because, you know, when I started out in California, there wasn't a lot of wrestling going around in California. And if you wanted to work, especially when I started, you know, you had to head down to the border and then go catch some lucha work and, you know, kind of scrape by with whatever you could. So, I mean, you know, that experience definitely helped out, man. But, yeah, he's a great cat. He worked in USWA for half a minute, and, he may not have gained the accolades, but he was a hell of a trainer and a hell of a guy, and broke me in the right way and took me on the road with him. And, I mean, it was just it was a great experience, a great dude.
Well, dude, what year did you break in the business?
99. Broke in 99, and, I mean, like I said, it was just doing little lucha shows, little weekend things. I wasn't really planning on making a career out of it. It was more I was kind of asked to I was doing judo, and they asked me, hey, we got a pro wrestling class. Guy's renting the gym out in the afternoon. You should come do it. And, you know, I bit, and it was a good workout, and I dug it. It was a weekend warrior thing, and next thing you know, here I am.
Well, check it out. So you started off, you're doing some judo. How far did you go to that, and what other sports did you participate in high school or growing up?
You know, being Samoan, football is kind of a religion in and of itself to a lot of Samoans. So, you know, played football, all my brothers did. Amateur wrestled for a little bit. But judo I did up until probably I started playing football 16 years old. I was a California State junior champ. And, I mean, I still love the sport. I still try to keep up with it and catch a spar every once in a while and get in there and roll around guys and, you know, find out if I still got what I had back then. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun, man. I enjoy it.
So what made you fall into the love? What made you, let me back up, what made you fall in love with the business of professional wrestling? When did you decide, hey, this is what I'm going to do?
Man, it really came down to just something that I knew and I was comfortable with. I mean, before I ever stepped foot in a ring, my parents owned a big college dance troupe, and we toured all over the world, man. You know, my first crib was a show trunk, and it's funny, my mom still has it, and she keeps it. And, you know, my dad wasn't a big proponent of daycare. You know, he didn't want nobody else raising his kids. If he was going to raise his kids, he was going to raise them himself, no matter what. So, I mean, we became part of the show, man. You know, everybody had a job. We drum, we dance, we sing, we do everything, the whole nine yards, and we pack up the whole damn thing and throw it in the back of the trailer and head on to the next town. So, I mean, it was a unique upbringing, but, I mean, it definitely prepared for us. Because when I got in the pro wrestling business, it was like, you know, what's this lifestyle like? Well, you travel all the time. You perform in front of people. You get done. You hit your hotel. You're on to the next town. I was like, well, shit, this is better than my regular job. I mean, fuck, before I had to actually clean up the goddamn stage and put shit away. At least this time, you know, a couple years I had to clean up a ring. But other than that, I mean, fuck, I get to head back to my hotel and relax for a little bit.
Well, how often were you guys on the road doing this, and how long did this last?
The show's still going today. My brother runs it. My parents are tired. I got them a place out here in Florida, and they're relaxing. But, I mean, yeah, they're still going strong. And, I mean, we were on the road probably, you know, 180 days a year. And this is not just domestically, I mean, internationally. I mean, we toured East and West Germany while the curtain was still up. Taiwan, Japan, China. I mean, we stayed pretty busy. So, I mean, as far as the road and the traveling and the scheduling and being out there and performing in front of people and knowing what this lifestyle is all about, I mean, I was already doing it, so it wasn't really that big of a transition.
Well, man, that's an interesting upbringing, and damn sure lends itself to life on the road as a professional wrestler. That's for damn sure. So,
and like a lot of guys too, man. When they run this by their loved ones, their parents and stuff, it was funny, man. I went to my dad and I said, "Papa, I really dig this wrestling thing. I think I'm going to pursue it as a career. I think I want to do this." And part of this was telling him I'm leaving the show, which is, you know, a saga in itself.
Yep.
And he looked at me and he said, "Well, son," he goes, "are you making money?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, as long as you're making money, that's all I care about. The day you don't make money, you get out. And I was like, you got to pop. Sounds like a fair deal to me.
So you start wanting to get into the business of professional wrestling. You need someone to train you. How do you find Cincinnati Red?
Since, like I said, man, I was down here. I was at a small little studio, a little hole-in-wall place, and I was doing judo and jiu-jitsu because that was like the new hot thing. Was done with football, really wasn't doing anything in the afternoons, always did something physical in the afternoons, got down there, was working out for a couple weeks, and basically the owner of the gym walked up to me and said, hey, man, a guy named John Dello, he goes, I do this little pro wrestling class after jiu-jitsu. He's like, do you want to stick around and try it out? And I was like, man, I don't know, man. Like, you know, it's pretty cool. And at the time, you know, you had the whole world on fire up at WWE, and it was all the rage. And I was just like, you know what, all right, I'll give it a shot. Let's try this out. So got in there, did some drills, realized a lot of judo stuff translated over pro wrestling, a lot of pro wrestling stuff translated back to judo and stuff. And, I mean, I got to admit, man, after the first couple of bumps, I was just like, hey, man, this is pretty cool. I dig this. And then after the first few shows and getting a lot of good feedback from people, I was like, you know, I think I'm going to explore this great adventure known as pro wrestling.
Now, well, how was Cincinnati Red with his training? I mean, obviously you guys were taking the bumps, and you said a key thing right there. You like taking bumps. There's so many people, man, and for me too, when I hit that mat, I fell in love because I dug the way it made my body feel, and I knew it was a part of the business. Some people can never adjust to that. For some people, that's an immediate turnoff. But with that being said, so there you are, training with Cincinnati Red. You've got a judo background. What kind of a 411 is he laying on you? Lots of chain wrestling, scientific stuff, because I mean you have a very interesting style.
Tons of chain wrestling, a lot of basing, a lot of getting light, getting up, being agile, never being heavy for guys. I mean just a lot of real like good like core technique training that, you know, you just don't see with a lot of guys, man. You know, like it was funny when I got out on the scene, I kind of figured that everybody was kind of trained in the same style that I was and was, you know, kind of forced to learn all different styles, not just the American style, but learn the Mexican style, have a working knowledge at the time of the Japanese style and other things. And I was surprised when, you know, that wasn't the case when I got out there. You know, some guys were trained on with a handkerchief and a dime, and other guys were awesome athletes who had really good pedigree. So, but just getting out there with Red, that's what he focused on. He's like, you know, you need to learn how to chain wrestle. And we did the basics first, man. I mean, I didn't get to do one cool thing until months. It seems like all I did was bump for the first 6 to 8
yep.
months and just learn how to protect myself. And that's the thing I tell cats. They go to wrestling school. You know, when I go to wrestling school, I learn how to do this. Listen, I go, you know what? You're going to go to wrestling school. You know, the most important thing you can learn in life, how to protect yourself. And, I mean, that's what I learned, man. I learned how to protect myself, man. And it was probably the best lesson I ever got in wrestling.
Well, check it out. So you're training with Red. You're getting the basics. You're learning how to bump some chain wrestling. All of a sudden, you're hauling ass and you're going down to Lucha Libre stuff. And, dude, you don't speak any Spanish, do you?
Well, as you found out living in LA, everybody's kind of got a working knowledge enough Spanish to make it happen. So, I mean, wrestling's a universal language, man. It's never been a problem in Japan, and it never was a problem in down in Mexico. And
it's a universal language, but that being said, a green cat going down to Mexico and being brought up, you know, with a judo background and with some pro training, all of a sudden you're in the lucha system. Dude, that's a whole different dynamic. That didn't fuck your head up?
Oh, God, it was organized chaos, man. I wouldn't even call it organized, man. I got down there and, you know, these cats are wanting to do 22 million different things, go 17 different ways. And I mean, at the time, like I said, I was just breaking in. I was green as the rolling hills. So I shut my mouth and tried to remember as much as I could and get the damn thing done.
Well, I mean, but that is a damn good way to come up. And especially when your brain is young and fresh and like a sponge can absorb all that stuff. I mean, because these days, as long as I've been in the business and, you know, I don't wrestle anymore, but I still consider myself in the business and somewhat of, a base of knowledge. But still to this day, when I watch, if I'm down in South Texas, I catch AAA or some other lucha stuff on TV. It's still a little foreign to me. I dig it. I see what these cats are doing. There's a couple of cats down there that I really like that are real aggressive. But, you know, still to me, I mean, it's your Rudos, your Technicos. It's just somewhat of a modified clusterfuck. I dig it. But it sure has brought a lot to your game because when I watch you, you know, I see some lucha. I see a lot of heavy Japan influence. I see, you know, obviously what you could do just from a pro style, you stand up brawling, chain wrestling. How would you define your style, or who helped influence or mold your style? Because you're just a combination of a lot of great things.
I think a lot of the agility and the speed came early from the lucha stuff. But I mean, the guy that really molded my style and really taught me a lot was kind of that guy that kind of sat me into the apple tree the first time and really, you know, gave me an epiphany about the business and what, you know, you're trying to do out there was probably Steve Regal. He came in for a little clinic. I was working at a WWE developmental territory at the time, doing some training and stuff. And Regal walked in, and I wrestled a match with him where I damn near stiffed the shit out of him every chance that I got, and was trying to beat the shit out of him to impress him. Much to my benefit, he didn't come in the back and rip my head off right away. He said that he recognized the potential. He sat me down, and we started talking about wrestling. And that one single talk was probably one of the biggest epiphanies in my life, because it changed my whole perception about what this business is about, what we're trying to achieve out there, what we're trying to communicate to the fans. And, I always thank you for that, man. It was always great. And like I said, it was a couple weeks, just some talks. And, like, you know, every once in a while, I'd give him a call and ask his advice on some stuff. And he was always helpful, always very gracious and always willing to help, a young guy like me kind of further in my career. And the other guy was Hashimoto in Japan. I mean, he was the first guy I worked for in Japan. And I went over there, and he just taught me all about presence, man, because that guy was 120% presence. I mean, he was a big, fat, chubby, Elvis-looking cat, but when he got in the ring, he was a beast, and it just was the aura about him, man. You know, he genuinely took on this crazy aura, and, you know, sitting across the ring from him every night, you know, on these house show tours out there and doing stuff, and, you know, you're bound to pick up something.
Now, you're talking about, there's a couple of Steve Regals in the business. You're talking about Lord Steven Regal, William Regal, correct?
Yes, I tell you what.
I was down there in WCW back, and it was 92, 93. I guess me and Brian had just started tagging up, if I remember correctly. They just brought Steve Regal in and called him Lord Steven Regal, whatever the hell it was. And, man, that cat went out there and had his first match and was selling like a sumbitch. And I said, holy shit, who is this guy? Because I'd never heard of him. And here he comes over. And, then, of course, you know, I caught him probably, 10, 12 already years in his career. And he was just the ultimate. And just like you said, he was a big influence on you. And you guys hit it off right off the bat. So as soon as his match was over, I went over and introduced myself to him because I didn't know if he knew, you know, who the hell I was. I wasn't nobody. I was Stunning Steve. And I shook his hand and said, hey, man. I said, man, I was, you know, badass shit. And we just started talking and became immediate friends. And we became travel partners. And God dang, we went up and down the road together and raised so much hell and had so much fun. And he was just to your point, he is one guy that had a tremendous influence on me and who truly understood what you're trying to do when you get in a squared circle.
Absolutely. And you know, you'll speak this too. I mean, you know, a lot of guys in wrestling, man, they won't give you the time of day when you're breaking in. But I mean, to have a guy like Steve Regal who's really accomplished at the time and already done so much in his career to actually, you know, spend the time and call me back and check on me and make sure that, you know, I was progressing. Now that it meant the world to me, and it really kind of gave me that confidence boost that, you know, maybe I can do this shit. I can do this for a living.
When did you, at what period of time, years in the business, did you feel like, hey, I've got a good hold of what's going on here from a mechanical standpoint and a psychological standpoint, when you thought you kind of had a pretty good package?
I think in the latter years of ROH, because I think, I've had a great opportunity to be a part of two companies kind of from the ground up, and Ring of Honor being one of them. And, came up with a great group of guys over there, too. A lot of my compatriots, they're doing fantastic. They're all around the industry. Punk, Daniel Bryan, Daniels, AJ, yep. And all these guys. And, being in a promotion like Ring of Honor, where you're responsible for the draw. I mean, there's no, people aren't showing up because, you know, the branding and stuff. I mean, people were showing up because I was responsible for packing that house.
You're selling tickets.
Yeah, we're selling tickets. So, I mean, right there, that in and of itself, that pressure in and of itself, which, you know, a lot of guys in wrestling nowadays just don't really get to feel outside of a...
No, because they're just on the machine.
Yeah, you're just on the team. You know, that pressure right there really kind of... I think sharpened us all, man. You know, I say, like, you know, get forged in the fires of battle. I think that period in ROH for a lot of guys, because it was on us. You know, it wasn't like we had a billion dollar promo team behind us promoting everything we did every week and trying to make us larger than life. I mean, we had to go out there and genuinely win these people over from the ground up. So, I mean, I think right there, that's when I started kind of honing it. And then definitely when I made the transition to TNA, started doing TV and, understanding the TV game in pro wrestling, which a lot of guys don't understand, is completely different than the pro game anywhere else or the independent level of pro wrestling, because now, you know, you're trying to tell an epic trilogy, and, you know, trying to fit, you know, $50 worth of dog shit in a teacup, and you know, so much time you're giving out there. So, I mean, you really, really, really gotta. You know,
it really cheats the fan, and I can, you know, I understand the dynamics of the television business, so many other people don't, but man, it, you know, to your point, you know, it's just, you don't get the real deal on today's television product just because everything's too fast forward and everybody's worried about changing the channel. But before we go back into TNA, because I want to ask you some questions about your current situation over there and talk about your first endeavor into that six-sided ring, but I want to go back quickly to Ring of Honor, because I watched a lot of your matches coming from there, and you know, several great ones with Austin Aries. And of course, you mentioned Daniel Bryan, CM Punk, and of course, you had a classic with a bigger guy, Kenta Kobashi, which was phenomenal. But you walk at what? You're 6'2", 250?
Yep, no, I'm 6'2", 280.
6'2", 280 right now. So, but check it out. Yep. So going back to the point I'm making, man, you've got the ability to work with a cat that's damn near half your size, because, you know, you're out there working, man, I mean, not 50-50, but I mean, you have the ability to work with a small guy, a big guy, or a guy in the middle. And a lot of people don't have that going for them. And man, just in watching your psychology, how you measure things, how you sell things, and then finally you'll do that kind of stunned, a little bit of a wobble in the middle of the ring, and wham, go down for that big bump. It's truly an art form to work with some of the cats that you have at a high level and a main event level, which I think you've done.
I appreciate it. Yeah, man. I mean, it is, man. And I think, you know, it's funny, you talk about psychology, and I remember, you know, early on in my career, I kept thinking to myself, you know, I overthought my psychology. Every little thing I was really trying to put crazy emphasis on. And then, you know, I kind of sat back and I was really, you know, the psychology of a fight is that it's a fight and it's chaotic, and that there's ebbs and flows, and some stuff hits clean and some stuff doesn't. And I mean, that's what I try to like really do now, man, is you know, I try to make what I do out there look rough. I try to make it look like a fight, because, you know, I'm out there to get into a fight. And I think the selling, you know, like you said, the selling aspect is something that's, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say it's a dying art form, but it's definitely an exclusive art form. And
agreed.
I think a lot of guys that are, you know, they just don't get that progressive sell mentality, and they, you know, they think too, you know, like I said, they think almost too cheesy, I guess is the term, you know, that to, you know, give them something flashy and something big, you know, right away to try to keep them tuned in. But, you know, when pro wrestling's done right, you know, there's no extraneous story needed, man. Everything that needs to be said can be said right there in that ring. I'm a firm believer in that. And a lot of that's said through the sound. And I think it's something that I would love to see focused more upon by, you know, the younger guys coming up.
It would be easy for a cat your size just to work with a lot of the guys that you work with and say, hey, man, I'm the big guy. I'm not going to sell this. I'm not going to take that bump. But, you know, I think you're smart enough at a very early age to realize, hey, these are the cats I'm working with. First of all, and you know, you don't seem like a selfish guy. Some guy will take that selfish, this is the easy way approach. But anytime, to go back to myself for a second, when I went to the ring with whoever it was, you know, hey, don't make a shit. Yeah, we've got to take into consideration a little bit of physical size here on that part. But the bottom line is, we both need to come out of this thing smelling like a rose. Now, it might be 50-50, 60-40, 90-10, depending on what the dynamic is. But when you're going out there and guys just are smaller than you, you've got to just run with that and be able to work with everybody. And that's what will help your ass draw money, because Jesus Christ, if all of a sudden you can play the strong man against everybody you work, hey, it's going to be a 90-10 match, and that ain't going to be worth a shit unless you're there purely to get over and not work a top program with anybody. So it takes a lot for a cat to realize that at a young age. And I was reading that you avidly train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Judo, which we covered, Muay Thai, at the L.A. Boxing in Costa Mesa, California. Is there any truth to that? Because you use a lot of the submissions, a lot of the jiu-jitsu in your pro game.
I have the weird fortune of, I grew up with a lot of guys who ended up, you know, I went to pro wrestling route. A lot of my friends ended up fighting. They're in UFC. They're part of UFC, currently are in UFC, or another fighting organization. So it was funny, man. It was you know, they'd be harping on me all the time. And then, I'd look over there and, you know, see all my starving fighter friends working their ass off to get a shot and coming up. And you know, because of that, I'd come down. And that's the way I like to train, man. I'm big about sparring. I love to get on the mat. I like to train with people, you know what I mean? I like to train combat and run drills and do stuff like that. And it's something I always dug when I was growing up, and I still dig doing today.
How far along are you?
I'm very fortunate to be surrounded by people like that.
How far along are you on the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu stuff? Do you have a belt?
It's more of a no-gi class. You know, it's more of a, you know, guys who are getting ready, tuning up for fights, getting ready and stuff like that. So, we don't grapple in the pajamas.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
Celebrity Big Brother is back, and we've got recaps of every single episode here on Rob as a Podcast. So whether you watch for the epic blindsides or for the insanity like Ricky Williams giving a colon massage to a constipated Kato Kaelin, yes, that happened. Check out our Celebrity Big Brother coverage on Rob as a Podcast on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, or the Podcast One app.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
I was talking about you blowing up your cardio conditioning. You know, you've got this Brazilian jiu-jitsu background, Muay Thai, judo. You got a lot of damn tools you can work with. But let's talk about your lungs. You don't seem to blow up. What's the story?
You got to learn how to breathe, man.
Got to relax, kid.
You got to know what to use and when to use it, man. I tell people all the time, man. I'm kind of like a specialist when it comes to dealing with big men. You know, a few big guys in the company, they'll come to me and they'll ask me for advice and opinions about how to, you know, work better. And one of the first things they always hit me up with, you know, we got Big Rob Terry, huge specimen of a man, a big Welsh powerhouse, yes, like Arnold Schwarzenegger times 10. And, you know, he was asking me, he's like, you know, how do I keep my wind going? How do I do that? And I explained to him simply, I go, look at yourself, man. You're walking around with a V8 chassis, but your gas tanks, your gas tank's still a Hyundai, bro. You still got the lungs same size as me, man. You got to efficiency of movement, my friend. You got to relax. You got to only use what you need to use and keep the rest away from when you need it. And, I mean, you can explain it to people all you want, but until they get those reps and experience and calm down and know how their body works and know when their muscles need oxygen and when their muscles need to shut down, it's one of those learned things, man. It's something I can't really come across in words. Just you need reps.
Hey, but check it out. Do you think the fact that you grew up in show business kind of detuned your nerves and got that aspect out of your system? Do you think that helped at all?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, man. I've had stage fright once in my life, and I've told this story before, but it was, you know, I was 5 years old. It was the 1984 Olympic opening ceremonies. We're doing the Polynesian dance out in the middle of the Olympic Stadium in Los Angeles, and you know, my dad, God bless him, he didn't really take into account that a costume change for the girls. Well, the girls are on the 50-yard line. They got to run all the way back in the locker room, change their costumes, run all the way back out to the 50-yard line, and finish up the dance. Well, you know, my pop didn't really put that into account. So the girls go running off to the 50-yard line. They're in the locker room. I'm sitting there behind the drum. We're sitting there just playing drums, dead air in front of 60,000 people in the middle of the stadium. So my dad, being the grand improviser, he just grabbed me by the scruff of my neck, threw me over the front of the drum, and said, "Do a solo, stall." So there I am, the 5 years old, in front of 60,000 people doing a solo, stalling. We got through it. They thought it was adorable, cute. Got a nice little picture in the paper, and ever since then, it was really hard to be scared of a crowd.
Now, if you come out of the ring a little bit and get some rust on you, does it take you a while to get your wind back, or is it just something that you've always had? Because if there's one thing, when I would come back from the ring after an injury or whatever, man, if I ain't in ring shape, you can get on a goddamn treadmill or elliptical machine or whatever. But to me, cardio is very specific. You need to be back in the ring, taking bumps, hitting those ropes, wrestling, exploding, relaxing, working before you get your damn wind back. Do layoffs affect you, or are you just a damn machine in the ring?
Yeah, they do. They do. If I'm 2 weeks off, you know, it takes me about a day and a half just to get reacclimatized to, you know, get back to where I am. It's just one of those weird things, man. I mean, I really wish I could tell you I was the crazy cardio machine that didn't need any tuning, but I mean, I definitely know and I haven't had many, but if I do have a 2 week layoff, I'm always dreading going back because I know that first one's going to be a pain in the ass.
Let's talk about we talked about your ring style, how you got up to speed with all the skills that you bring into the ring. It comes down to name yourself. You come up with Samoa Joe. How did you come up with that name? What was the process that you went through? Were there any other things that were almost things you used?
This is the most ridiculous story ever, but I mean, it's more form over function, definitely. I mean, with the gym that I worked at, there was a couple guys named Joe, and one guy was regular Joe, one guy was Samoa Joe, and I remember when I debuted in wrestling, not taking it. Not thinking that it would go this far, you know, kind of the first week of wrestling, the guy goes, "Oh, well, just be Samoa Joe in the ring." So I was, and I was for my first few indie shows. The problem was, after my first few indie shows, you know, all of a sudden, a few local promoters started calling and saying, "Hey, we want Samoa Joe on our show." And then it was a couple out-of-state promoters. And then, you know, as it kind of grew, I didn't dare change my name because I didn't want to miss out on any work for people going, "Well, I wanted Samoa Joe, not fucking Lance Super Saber, or you know, like right. whatever, what the hell it would have been. I mean, I didn't even get a chance to really flesh out what I wanted my name to be. And like I said, lo and behold, a couple of years later, I was like, well, shit, I guess I got to stick with it.
Hey, man, let's talk about that match with Kenta Kobashi. Was that the first time you worked with him, that shot in Ring of Honor?
Yep, first time ever. We had met previously a couple times when I was over in Japan, just real brief, you know, hey, how you doing meetings? And then, when we got into New York, and, we got down.
Man, that was a hell of a damn match. It was just a great match, a hell of a damn match. So, obviously, mutual respect on both sides. Had he seen you from, film past or knew who and what you were?
Yeah, man, mutual respect. It was funny, man, you know, Kobashi coming into America, you know, he really thought that nobody knew who the hell he was. And he also thought that, you know, he wasn't going to get a reaction. He thought he was going to be booed like he was Mr. Fuji or something. I mean, that was really his perception of what would happen in America. He'd never been over here before.
Right.
And I'm trying to explain to him in my somewhat conversational Japanese that, you know, everybody out there knows you. Everybody knows who you are. Trust me, your tapes have been sold illegally to all these people well before this match was ever put in place. So, you know, they know everything. So then, you know, we're calling the match, and he's calling. And we're starting to put together this match. I mean, he's making it really, '60s heelish.
Right.
You know, I'm the evil Japanese guy. I remember at one point kind of stopping everything and turning around, looking to him, explaining to him, trust me, big baby face.
Right.
Don't worry about anything. You guys go out there, we'll kick ass. Love. Let me do my thing. You do your thing, and they will love it. Don't change anything. So, you know, they had a little bit of a hard time, you know, kind of taking my word for it. But then finally, the managing guy over there got him to sign on, and we went out there. And I mean, when he walked through that curtain, I think that fan reaction was enough to convince him that, all right, these people are here to see me. And I mean, we had a lot of fun. It was brutal. It was physical, but. You know, when you're given those opportunities, not a lot of guys in wrestling are, you take full advantage of it, and I had a blast, man.
Man, it's a great vibe in that little arena. Where was that? Because, I mean, there's a couple thousand people there. It wasn't the biggest place in the world, but, man, the atmosphere was badass. And, of course, like you said, as soon as he came through the curtain, they knew who he was. They knew exactly what they were getting, and they got a great match. I don't know if they knew what they were going to get a great match or not, but they sure knew who he was. But it was just a great atmosphere. And sometimes those smaller venues are better than a big ass stadium.
Well, absolutely, man. I think any time that you get, 1,000 impassioned fans compared to 5,000 kind of wayward fans in a spread out arena, you always got a better situation going on. And that night, especially Ring of Honor, with that kind of zealotness of a fan base and them loving Japanese wrestling, which they did, which was the whole reason that the company was created in the first place. It was kind of the perfect mix of everything. It was a perfect night, man. It was, you know, crowd, wrestlers, energy, everything. It all came together, and it was a blast. And it's one of those fond memories you look back on and go, "Hell, we tore the roof off, and we had a hell of a time doing it."
Let's take a little segue into right now. I want to talk a little bit about your first foray into TNA and the curtain situation going on right there right now. But how are you on a physical level right now? How are you feeling? What are you, 34 years old?
Yeah, 35 actually.
35. How are you feeling? Any major injuries in the ring?
Nah, man. I've been pretty fortunate in the ring. I mean, I've only suffered one concussion my entire career. I liken that to, you know, really understanding the dynamics of how to flow with things and not put yourself in too much danger. But
agreed.
I mean, this probably over the past month, I had some shoulder injuries. You know. Some elbow and stuff, but I mean, mainly minor kind of bumps and bruises, wear and tear stuff that you normally get. But I've been fortunate enough, knock on a damn oak tree, that I haven't had too many very, very serious injuries, and thankfully nothing involving my spine and my neck, because I know how many that affects a lot of dudes, and I do not envy that condition, my friend.
So, dude, when you take a guy your size and you're doing all the great moves, you use the suplexes, the submission game, and then you think, hey, man, I'm a big ass cat. I'm gonna haul ass, hit the ropes, and dive through the second, third ropes on a cat. On top of all the other great shit I'm doing, no bad spills on that. That hadn't come back to haunt you yet. It's a dynamic move. It looks great.
That's the one thing I don't understand, man. Like that dive before I even started doing it, man. Like I must have done it a million times, using a crash pad and really understanding how my body was going to land and stuff. Because, you know, I understood, man, you can't be doing that dive all the time and landing on that hip and expect it to last your entire career. So, I mean, it's something I've worked on. Let me put it that way. I worked on to the point where, you know, I take as little damage as possible when I do eventually hit the ground.
Two things that really kicked me as far as high impact, the muscle buster. Did you invent that? Where did that come from?
That came from a drunken night in Japan.
Around, in a hotel room?
At a hotel, sitting around eating Korean barbecue, wondering what we're going to do till 4 in the morning that night. And then in our drunken super, seeing a ridiculous poster and with a ridiculous Japanese anime cartoon on it of wrestling, and then somehow, some way, we ended up in this place, and the owner put, I guess the owner was a big mark for this this muscle thing that they had over there, and so he put on the TV show they're watching, and the guy did the muscle buster. I said, "Well, shit, that's a hell of a move. I think we'll start using that." And lo and behold, I think I came back to the States and I immediately started putting it out as my finisher.
Well, dude, when you start breaking that down to a cat and he's looking at you and you're explaining this thing, I can only imagine the looks in people's eyes as you're trying to drop the 411 of what you want to do to them.
Yeah, I mean, sitting there and trying to tell a guy about the muscle buster, it's one of the funniest things ever, because, I mean, it's like, I'm going to take you, I'm gonna hoist you up on my shoulder, your neck's going to be jammed here, I'm going to have both your ankles in my hands, and I'm going to proceed to run out in the middle of the ring and spike you. Is that cool? I mean, it's just, it's a tough proposition, but I think if a lot of people didn't kind of respect my ability to take care of them much they did, I don't think I'd ever get that move off.
No, dude, I mean, I'm a guy with a history of neck problems, but when I see that, and after you seeing you do it, if you were going to explain it to me before then, maybe not so much, but after seeing it, it looks totally 100% safe the way you do it.
I've worked it out to where, you know, we all get hurt, but we never want to get injured, so that's the mantra as far as that goes.
So check it out, dude. I got to ask, you go into TNA, they got this six-sided ring, you get in there. Well, you got to be thinking, what the fuck? Did you adapt immediately? I think what's going on in your head?
First day I looked in there, I was just like, this is something interesting. But you know, it's funny, man. But as I started to work in it, I really dug the six-sided ring. I mean, it was no matter which way you went, you were always going the right way eventually. So I mean, it kind of worked out okay.
So then I was I remember, I think I sent out a tweet back before they changed to the square. What was the internal decision of when they decided to go to the square ring?
I think that was more directly Hogan and Bischoff. I think they felt that wrestling fans were acclimatized to the four sides and the six sides,
funnel
things, confused things. So I think that was kind of the decision behind it. And I mean, the logic sound behind it. I mean, it really didn't, put a hitch in my craw about anything than doing that. So, I mean, it was all good for me. I mean, hell, just put me in there. It doesn't matter who's in there, as long as we get the job done.
So, man, let's talk about TNA. You've been down there for a pretty good while now. How long has it been?
Yep, about 8 years now, I think.
Man, shit, I ain't going to get you any hot water, but I love your work. Why don't they light your ass on fire, throw up a big green light, and push you to the moon?
Well, that's it's one of those many things that is far and away out of my hands. And, I show up to work every day with a smile on my face, ready to do the best that I can, and that's all I can do, man.
I hear you, and duly noted, and good answer, because, what do you say to that?
Granted, it is a political answer, but, honestly, it's truly the way I feel, man. Like, I don't get stressed out about things like that, because, at the end of the day, I'm confident enough in my own abilities, I'm confident enough in what I'm able to do in the ring, and I'm confident enough in the fact that it's given the opportunity, I'll run with it. So, they gave me the opportunity, they gave me that one little open window shot, they get my foot in the door, don't worry, I'll kick it down and we'll have a lot of fun.
There's been a couple of matches I've watched you, and you put some guys over clean in the middle with their finish. And to a lot of guys that would go out there that I've known in the past and would go out there totally with a boo-boo face. They would go out there and you could read their body language. You could look at their face and they're doing a J-O-B because of, they didn't want to do business. And, and I've turned down doing a couple of jobs because it wasn't good business. But by and large, I've always done the right thing. I've seen you go down in the middle of the ring clean and it never hurts you because of the way you do it. And to me, it gives me a high level of respect for you because of the way you take care of the business and the way you can take care of your business.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to stuff like that, the only thing that gets me mad about me ever losing in the ring is when they don't do something with it. You know what I mean? That's the only thing that ever hurts me. As far as my shoulders going down on the mat, I mean, it's wrestling. We'd all love to be the big champion every day, but at the same time, this is a business. It's an entertainment business. Conflict and controversy creates cash. You got to have conflict. You got to controversy. You can't always. The formula has to change up. You can't be the invincible juggernaut forever. And I realize that. And I come to grips with that. Some fans they don't, but I mean, I understand that, and I appreciate that, man. That's great. But, I mean, going out there, and like you said, knowing how to do it, too, is also important. You know, I mean, I've seen plenty of examples of guys going out in the ring and losing. And, you know, and I hate to yank the chain a little bit, but, I mean, one of the big examples that is always brought up, and it is kind of like, you know, like, I don't know how many times I've heard this, but, you know, you and Bret Hart, you know, when you passed out, you know, with the blood streaming down your face, I mean, that was the way that, hey, you went out. But, I mean, after that match was set, all said and done, I mean, I think everybody, you were infinitely 20 times better off than you were before going in that match, which is hard to believe considering how hot things were at the time. So it's like, you know, you take a little bit of that mantra, and, you know, there's always the right way to do things. And then, you know, it's pro wrestling, it's individual accomplishments. At the end of the day, it's a team sport, and we're all going to succeed together. You know, you better be ready to make those sacrifices when the time comes.
There's always a time, you know, when there's too many losses, and that's when it's time to speak up. But I remember, you know, back in the day when I first went to WWF, man, I was doing a job every single night, getting kicked in the chin by Sean, and, you know, and then passing out and doing a sharpshooter thing with Brett or whatever. I was that mid-range guy, and hadn't started pushing me yet, and I was just getting jobbed out every night. But I'll tell you something, man, from a learning standpoint and from a different dynamic than where you're at right now currently in your career, man, getting your ass beat every night can damn sure open your eyes and teach you a lot of things, man, because anybody can go out and win a match. It takes a real sumbitch to go out there and lose a match and actually learn something from that match and, you know, accomplish that to build a rapport with those people. That's how you lose, man. I mean, you can get bit clean, you can get beat quick, 1, 2, 3, whatever, but you can leave that sumbitch smelling like a rose despite the fact that it's an L.
Yep. And like I said, man, I think the other big thing, the fact that draws to that is, like, you know, say, growing up with a lot of guys who, you know, who fight as a career and for their life and stuff. I mean, you know, when these guys lose, they get the shit beat out of them, and I got to go visit them in the hospital and, you know, try to look at their face and act like it ain't as bad as it looks. But, you know, when I lose, at least I get to go down to Cracker Barrel and, you know, have myself a sandwich and a Diet Coke and call it a night. I mean, it's, you know, it really, in the reality of things, if you're worried about that shit, I mean, you know, you're kind of like, you're not really getting the business.
Hey, man, Joe, we talked about a lot of stuff in the business and around the business and all this other bullshit, but as a human being, what does Joe like to do to chill out, relax? You got any hobbies?
Love to fish. Big fisher, like DC fish. We got a boat down here in the bay, and we get out every once in a while. Love video games. You know, big video game player since I was a kid, and now, you know, I've been fortunate enough that a lot of my friends are great game developers, and they you know, they send me a bevy of free things every month, so that works out nice. And you know, I'm a real simple guy, man. I believe it or not, I like doing yard work, like taking care of my house, like doing shit myself. I don't dig paying people to do manual labor on my own property and stuff. It's weird to me. So yeah, man. I mean, I got pretty pedestrian hobbies, but you know, when you spend as much time as you do out on the road and doing crazy shit, you know, the pedestrian stuff is very, very appealing.
Well, when you're going out on that boat, are you driving a boat? You get lost, you know what you're doing, you got someone out there with the GPS and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, I come from a long line of fine ocean navigators. I don't know any of that shit, but I got a hell of a GPS system, so, yeah, I always know where the hell I'm at.
Oh, man, we grew up fishing down here in South Texas. My dad take off driving that boat, and, you know, I never paid attention. I always had my head up my ass thinking about something, and, you know, hell, if I ever had to get us back to safety, we'd be fucked, because all we had was a campus on that little piece of shit we used to ride around on with the outboard motor. But I say, you like to fish, you chill, you play the games. How are you in with this whole technology thing, man? Are you involved with all this shit? If you're a gamer, how are you on this computer stuff?
The gamer stuff. See, it's funny, man. There's always a couple guys who have a travel system in their bag. So they actually have a bag with a dedicated TV in the motherfucker and an Xbox, and it's beautiful. So,
Joe, if you tell me you motherfuckers are playing video games in the locker room, I'll drive down to TNA and smoke the shit out of everybody in that sumbitch. Video games are fine, but you can't be doing that shit in the locker room when you got business to take care of. Please tell me you ain't playing video games in the dressing room.
Absolutely. Yeah, none of that shit in the locker room. No, it's mostly, you know, hotel stuff. We're on the road, or, you know, on a long 200-mile drive, it's got a damn car charger, so we just plug that in, and, you know, at least for 2 hours, you can, you know, play, you know, Atlanta versus the Rams instead of sitting around listening to bad road stories told over and over again.
Hey, speaking of road stories, I was talking to you the other day. I was talking the other day, and I said, man, I said, if you can drum up a couple of stories that not too many people's lives are exposed or whatever, where you could tell. You got any good stories from the road? Anything funny from the ring that's happened to you lately or back in the day?
Man, I swoof. I guess the saga of JD Dempsey is a great story for this podcast, because you can be a little more liberal with what we say. But I am married to JD Dempsey. JD, you know, good dude, really, really great heart. But when I first worked in Japan, he was working over there too. He had a minimal amount of pro wrestling training. You know, he's a pro wrestler, but he was an ex-boxer. And the company that I worked for, they did half, you know, work shoot fights and half pro wrestling. So it was kind of a weird mix of guys we had on the tour. So JD Dempsey, you know, being a boxer he was, he'd taken a few to the head here and there, and you know, he'd talk like, I'm JD Dempsey. And this is, if you met, you'd be, hey, Steve Austin, pleasure to meet you. I'm JD Dempsey. You're a bitch. No, you're not. Yes, you are. Like, he just fucking, he talked in circles to himself, everything. Right. It was great. But the best part was he had no filter when it came to promos, and then you combine that with Japanese television, which, you know, they'll let you say damn near anything because they're not translating half of what you said anyways. And we get out there, and it's my first TV interview in Japan, and, like, you know, we're sitting there, and we're thinking, oh, we've got to be prim and proper. It's Japanese television. You can't act like a fool on Japanese television. You got to act like, you know, it's a serious fight and a serious word. But so they start off the interview, and, of course, they start the press conference to JD Dempsey, who, for an hour press conference, which everybody was supposed to speak, he proceeds to take up 45 minutes of it, screaming, first of all, fuck Japan. I'm here for your yen and your women. Also, again, I hate you. I hate this TV station. This host is ugly. I don't know. I mean, and proceeds to launch the most racist tirade against Asian people I've ever heard in my entire life. So we're sitting there, and he does this whole thing, and you know, all the other Americans, we're on this side, we've got our heads in our hands, and we're trying to not bust up beyond belief at him just going off. And so he finally gets on the tirade, we do the rest of the show, and now here comes the final out. So here we are, we're all lined up at the thing, and it's supposed to be a quick little, hey, check out my fight tomorrow night. I hope I'm going to win. Thank you very much. And then they translate into something else that you didn't say anyways. So we go down the line, the first couple guys, and the third guy, of course, is JD Dempsey. And JD Dempsey gets up there and goes, all right, I'll fucking, I told you once again, all you guys are fucking bitches. I hate this place. I wish all you people would die. Fuck Hashimoto. Fuck Ogawa. You're all a bunch of punk ass. And they drops the N-word. We go off TV. I'm sitting there kind of staring at everybody. I'm just like, did he just call everybody in Japan a bunch of... And, of course, he, you know, I look at JD Dempsey. I said, Dempsey, man, what are you doing, man? What did you say after that stuff? He said, well, what did I say? I thought I was very entertaining and enlightening. It's just... That's the saga of JD Dempsey, man.
Joe, let's talk about 5-10 years down the road. Theoretically, where are you going to be? Still in the ring?
I hope so, man. I hope so. I think 5 or 10 years down the road, I'll still be wrestling. But, you know, I also have some other ventures going on. So, I mean, hopefully 5-10 years down the road, I'll be wrestling on my terms. That's my biggest goal.
Wrestling on terms. I read you do a little bit of stunt work. You got interested in acting, anything like that?
You know, a little bit. Like, you know, living out in L.A., I had a lot of opportunities to, you know, did the casting call visits and stuff, did some work for CBS. Under Norman Howe, who's an awesome dude and, you know, legend up there as far as stuntmen go. And, you know, we actually filmed a bunch of stunt scenes for Jericho and some CSI Miami, or I think, yeah, CSI Miami. You know how it works.
Joe, you guys got an interesting situation going on down there with Aces and Eights. How's that shaking out? You guys going to weather the storm?
Oh, we'll weather the storm. I mean, eventually, hopefully it'll shake out in the ring, and we'll get all parties involved in one big brouhaha, and we'll figure out what's what. So, I mean, that's what I'm gunning for. I think we're pushing for that next week, and we'll see how it all comes about.
Let's give a shout-out to our friends over at GEICO for supporting the podcast. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, I'm giving Sean a go-home cue, so let's wrap it up for this week. Make sure you check out podcast1.com and subscribe to the Steve Austin Show so you don't miss any of these classic episodes. Before I ride off in the sunset, I do want to throw out a couple of plugs. I still got a beer. It's the badass Broken Skull IPA, the finest IPA in the United States of America, and that's the bottom line. Made by El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably SOL. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, I got two for you. Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife, Cold Steel Working Man Knife. Get them at my Amazon store.
Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass knives. Also, one more big shout out to all my sponsors to make this show possible. That's how I'm able to bring this show to you free twice a week. Please support them because they support us. For more info, check out the podcast description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Steve Austin BSR. Folks, I'll be back soon, but until then, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.